has standardized a procedure for dealing with the use of electronic devices more effectively than, oddly enough, the airlines. They've been on the case for years. That now leaves the rest of us to figure out what our policies and procedures ought to be. In dealing with screen addiction, the inexperienced must lead the even less experienced. Since we don't know what to call the phenomenon of excessive or inappropriate use of electronic devices, we don't know how to talk about it very well. We don't even know how much use is excessive or precisely what is inappropriate. A decade ago, former Microsoft executive Linda Stone observed that people paid continuous partial attention to just about everything. We are always scanning for opportunities, for the next excitement, the next hit, the next twinge of happiness or anger from good news or bad, whatever wandering digital image or thought that lights up the various corners of our brains. We're glued to our screens because, like gamblers, we want to see what comes up on the next roll of the screen dice. Since Stone first offered that observation, the problem of continuous partial attention has ballooned into one of the signal, pun intended, difficulties of our time. The new condition characterized by the misuse of electronic devices has acquired various names assigned by various groups. These include problematic computer use, PCU, computer addiction, CA, communication addiction disorder, CAD, and internet addiction, IA. Then there's the term the psychiatric profession's new diagnostic manual, the DSM-5, first came up with, internet use disorder, which went by the unfortunate acronym IUD. Later, the definition was narrowed and the name changed to internet gaming disorder. It is not an official diagnosis, but rather is listed in the section of the DSM-5 called Conditions for Further Study. Here's how the DSM-5 defines internet gaming disorder. Persistent and recurrent use of the internet to engage in games, often with other players, leading to clinically significant impairment or distress as indicated by 5 or more of the following in a 12-month period. 1. Preoccupation with internet games. The individual thinks about previous gaming activity or anticipates playing the next game. Internet gaming becomes the dominant activity in daily life. Note, this disorder is distinct from internet gambling, which is included under gambling disorder. 2. Withdrawal symptoms when internet gaming is taken away. These symptoms are typically described as irritability, anxiety, or sadness, but there are no physical signs of pharmacological withdrawal. 3. Tolerance. The need to spend increasing amounts of time engaged in internet games. 4. Unsuccessful attempts to control the participation in internet games. 5. Loss of interests in previous hobbies and entertainment as a result of, and with the exception of, internet games. 6. Continued excessive use of internet games despite knowledge of negative psychosocial problems. 7. Has deceived family members, therapists, or others regarding the amount of internet gaming. 8. Use of the internet games to escape or relieve a negative mood, e.g., feelings of helplessness, guilt, anxiety. 9. Has jeopardized or lost a significant relationship, job, or educational or career opportunity because of participation in internet games. Note, only non-gambling internet games are included in this disorder. Use of the internet for required activities in a business or profession is not included, nor is the disorder intended to include other recreational or social internet use. Similarly, sexual internet sites are excluded. Specify current severity. Internet gaming disorder can be mild, moderate, or severe, depending on the degree of disruption of normal activities. individuals with less severe internet gaming disorder may exhibit fewer symptoms and less disruption of their lives. Those with severe internet gaming disorder will have more hours spent on the computer and more severe loss of relationships or career or school opportunities. I find the DSM-5 description too narrow, as the problem extends far beyond just gaming. I choose to call this syndrome by the broadest and most inclusive term I can think of: problematic use of electronic devices, PUED, thereby covering the widest ground possible. In my classification, the use of any electronic device for communication, learning, business, entertainment, or anything else that causes a serious behavioral problem as perceived by the user or any other person or group might be considered worthy of diagnosis and treatment by a medical or mental health professional. I leave the term intentionally ambiguous and vague because we're in vague and ambiguous territory. What's normal in one setting, say the office of a trader on the commodities exchange, would be excessive in the waiting area of a funeral parlor. As I've noted, we have no universally accepted social norms. For some passengers, someone speaking on his cell phone on the commuter rail may be fine. For others, it may be beyond the pale. Answering a cell phone during dinner may be no problem for one spouse, but grounds for a big argument for another. One person's problematic use is another person's normal. I have classified PUED into 5 levels. Les had reached level 5, the addictive level. He needed help. He dimly recognized that he was in trouble, but some kind of outside intervention would be his best source for recovery. It may sound strange, even alarmist, to apply terms like recovery and addiction to the use of electronics, our era's great and defining gift. Yet we are now at a stage where these wonderful tools can and often do impair and even ruin lives. Fortunately, there is reliable help for Les and others like him. It is not as difficult to overcome the problematic use of electronics as it is to quit smoking or control drinking. In this case, what is needed is not abstinence. Few people can live in today's world without using electronics, so abstinence is not an option. To fix the problem, Les and others like him should begin by naming the problem and by owning up to its severity. Les fell prey to what used to be a joke: excessive use of electronics, but is a joke no more. It is a fast-growing, major disorder. As is true of all addictions, near addictions, or bad habits, the first hurdle is to overcome denial. Les doesn't want to give up his binky, his electronics, because he's come to prefer his screen life to his real life. That's true of all addicts. The addiction provides a pleasurable state of mind that cannot reliably be found in ordinary life. Despite having a great wife, a job rife with opportunity, and a boss who wanted to help him grow, Les fell back into addiction out of a fundamental lack of faith in himself and a feeling of powerlessness to advance his career. My job was to challenge Les sufficiently to get his attention, but not so much as to beat him down. He was already beaten down enough. Addicts don't like themselves very much. Neither does the world. Indeed, they are among our most despised citizens, scorned by themselves and by society. The trick for me was to replace the moral diagnosis that Les, at some deep level, had attached to himself. Namely, you are bad, weak, undisciplined, and a loser, and replace it with a morally neutral diagnosis that confers some hope, like, you have important gifts you have yet to unwrap. I gave with one hand, you have talent, and I took with the other. Get off your butt and use that talent. It was great when he got mad at me. anger is a good spur to action, the first sign a person is emerging from lethargy. But I always had to be careful not to hurt his feelings so much that he'd shut down and withdraw. As with most addicts, Les possessed far more talent than he realized or used. One reason I like to work with all kinds of addicts is that they have the potential to make great progress once they are out of denial and feel some hope. Addictions of all kinds cost businesses much more than most people realize. Not only do they cause millions of illnesses and deaths, they also cause poor or suboptimal performance in the workplace, which Les's case vividly demonstrates. The solution is simple, but extremely difficult to enact. Turn it off. T-I-O. Of course, were it that easy, we wouldn't need treatment programs and addictions, tobacco, alcohol, illicit drugs, sex, food, and gambling, would not be costing some $559 billion per year in the United States. Were addictions easy or only rather difficult to treat, they wouldn't be costing us countless lives and vast sums of money. The fact is that addictions pose a problem science has not come close to solving. So difficult are addictions to treat that we have not yet found a program that consistently achieves even modest success. Alcoholics Anonymous and 12-step programs in general, widely recognized as the gold standard in the treatment of addictions, achieve a shockingly low success rate, but their mediocre track record is the best we have. About 1 in 15 people who enter AA or other 12-step programs will be able to become and stay sober, a depressing 5% to 10% success rate. That is not to say that I don't recommend AA and 12-step programs. I do. They're the best standardized programs we have. They start where all treatment ought to start, in human connection. 12-step programs replace the drug of abuse with human fellowship, and therein resides the heart of their success. In working with Les, I prescribed human connection as a replacement for screen time. It was not an easy sell, but the best way to go. From there, I followed a psychological model proposed by Lance Dodes, M.D., a retired Harvard Medical School professor who spent his entire professional career helping people who struggled with addiction. He believes that addiction serves to reverse an overwhelming sense of helplessness. The minute the addict decides to use, be it alcohol, sex, spending, gambling, or, in Les's case, electronics, the addict feels better. He feels pleasure and relief just from having made the decision to use. It is not the substance or the activity that brings the pleasure at first, but the decision to use it. Making a decision to use replaces a feeling of helplessness with a feeling of control, which confers its benefits even before the substance or the activity enters the system. Dodes goes on to say that while relieving helplessness is the function of addiction, the driving force behind it is rage at that helplessness, like a prisoner raging at the bars that surround him. So intense is the rage that it overrides sound judgment and self-interest. But rather than feel the rage and express it directly, which could reverse the addiction, the addict shies from that. He uses his drug or activity rather than feeling his true emotions. As Dodes puts it, every addictive act is a substitute for a more direct behavior. In the context of the human connection Les made with me, we were able to draw out his feelings and find direct expression. He did indeed feel helpless that he could not advance in his career or live up to his expectations or those of others. And he did indeed feel rage at this, much as any person perpetually held back feels rage. Once he was able to access those feelings, it became far easier for him to give up what Dr. Edward Kantzian, another giant in the field of addiction research, calls his self-medicating, and replace that with more constructive expressions of feelings so that he came out of his addictive shell. In dealing with addiction, near addiction, and maladaptive patterns of using, I recommend a combination of a 12-step program. There's nothing to lose, there's fellowship to gain, and it's the best standardized program out there, as well as the psychological model DODES espouses. We got lucky because Les came to see me without a lot of prodding. This is unusual for an addict who has not hit bottom and who is not mandated by the court to seek help. He came because he read one of my books and saw himself in it. "I want to check you out," he announced. If he had not opened the door, he likely would have lost his job and his marriage before seeking help. But fate intervened, so he got a head start. With the collaboration of his wife Lynn and his boss Carl, I was able to set up a plan whereby Les could look at his behavior objectively, get support from a group of people with various kinds of addiction, which I referred him to, and use a daily plan of behavior modification aimed at reducing his screen sucking, while replacing it with activities that used more of his creative faculties. When I apply the basic plan to treat ADT to Les and others like him who struggle with screen sucking, I note the following dangers associated with each element of the plan. 1. Energy. The addiction to electronics drains mental energy like a slow cerebral bleed. 2. Emotion. When you screen suck, you enter into a kind of trance and are emotionally neutral. You feel no joy, rage, or sorrow. You feel very little. 3. Engagement. Feeling so little emotion, your only sense of engagement is with the screen, with the ongoing synaptic stimulation you get. So you disengage with the important tasks, people, and ideas with which you might otherwise be engaged. 4. Structure. The structure of the electronic device and the systems it connects you with cause you to surrender your attention. This is an example of how structure can work against you. The very force that could be your ally becomes your enemy, with your permission. 5. Control. In addiction, and bad habits in general, you fail to exercise the control you have. At some level, you lose that control. That's what intervention aims to do. Restore your control. Most people who contend with the problem of screen sucking do not become addicted, as Les did, or even nearly addicted. Nonetheless, their habit can cause major reductions in their productivity. To help these people, I offer some practical tips for fixing the problem. What to do about it? 10 tips for reducing screen sucking. 1. Honestly assess how much time you spend on electronics every day. Most people grossly underestimate this figure. If you can, keep a record of use of electronic devices, an RUED. Just jot down when you log on and off, or record your on and off times in a voice memo. 2. Based on your RUED or estimated RUED, gauge where you could cut back. Don't say you can't cut back. You can. This is likely your largest or nearly largest waste of time, so don't squander a good chance to reclaim the time you've surrendered. 3. Create pockets in your day reserved for screen time. A half hour in the morning, a half hour in the afternoon, whatever works for you. Outside those pockets, turn it off. Have an assistant notify you if you are urgently needed. Make your coworkers and customers aware that you may not be available at all times. 4. Turn off your devices during social engagements like luncheons and coffee breaks. 5. When you get bored, don't use your electronic device like a binky. Do something more productive when you are bored. Read an article you've been meaning to read, or call an associate you've been meaning to contact, or write the difficult memo you've been putting off. 6. Keep a list in your notes, wherever you store notes, of things to do when bored other than screen suck. 7. Avoid addictive or habit-forming websites and games. You know which ones they are for you. Once you get out of the habit of visiting them, they will fade into the oblivion they ought to occupy. 8. Encourage your group or division where you work to collaborate on creating an email policy. When to send messages, when not to, what's the expected turnaround time for an email, how lengthy an email should be before it becomes onerous to read, and so forth. 9. Make judicious use of the human moment. That is, face-to-face communication. While more expensive and cumbersome, human moments are infinitely richer and more powerful than electronic moments. 10. Measure and monitor your progress. The more progress you make, the more motivated you'll feel to continue to cut back on screen sucking. Monitor not only the time you save, but also the increase in the volume and quality of your work that you will most assuredly enjoy. Chapter 2. Multitasking. How to say no when you have more to do than time to do it. People who fit the category of ADT outlined in this chapter tend to agree with the following statements. I can't get my work done without multitasking. Saying no is very hard for me to do. I'd own my own company or be in charge of the one I work at now if I could just manage my time more effectively. If I could just get organized, I'd be far more successful. If only I could clone myself, I'd be fine. At work, I have more trouble than the average person in preventing interruptions. I wish people at work would leave me alone so I could get stuff done. Oh, what I'd give for just one uninterrupted hour. Jean hit the snooze button again. How many more times could she hit it before she had to get up? Each time she pushed the button, she got 10 more blessed minutes of sleep before being reawakened by a hissing blast of radio static. She'd been so tired the night before that she'd pushed a wrong button on their new system. She didn't yet know how to tune it properly to her favorite station, and she hadn't wanted to interrupt her husband's TV show to ask him to do it for her. "You're a big girl, you can figure it out," Lou would have responded, implying that she was both technologically incompetent and, worse, lazy. So she'd gone to sleep, knowing she'd be awakened this cold winter morning by static. So deep was her desire for sleep, those treasured, tender, loving arms of sleep, that she hadn't cared. Now the question she faced was how many more 10-minute blocks of snooze button sleep she could wangle from her conscience before the combination of guilt and necessity drug her out of bed, as her Kentucky bred father would have said. 2 snoozes later, she was in the shower, while Lou, who'd slept through the static, began to stir. Standing with her eyes closed, facing up into the bracing blast of water coming from the showerhead, she and Lou shared a love of a strong shower. She wished the shower could last all day. Here was one place she could be alone and uninterrupted. Alone with her thoughts, she often did her best thinking and planning here. When she finally turned off the water and stepped out, Lou slapped her affectionately on her butt and said, "Long shower, hun. You leave me any hot water?" "Sorry," Jean said. "I got lost in my thoughts." 15 minutes later, she'd somehow done her hair and makeup. She frowned disapprovingly at her bloated face in the mirror, knowing that she really, really needed to shed a good 20 pounds. "I've got to get to the gym again," she thought, as she hastily slipped on her underwear, skirt, blouse, jacket, and shoes. She rushed downstairs to the kitchen to prepare breakfast for Lily and Isabel, while Lou got ready to go to the hospital. She and Lou had a routine that worked, even though it seemed to Jean that it worked better for Lou than for her. Even so, she loved him and her girls. She just wasn't sure how much she loved her life. Part of Jean's responsibility was also to make sure her daughters actually did get downstairs. Now in the third and fifth grades, respectively, they each had chores. Lily's job was to make sure Bouncy, their calico cat, got her tin of wet food, while Isabel fed Falstaff, their black lab. It would have been easier for Jean to feed the pets herself, but she was trying to teach her girls to be responsible. They already took it for granted that their breakfast would be waiting for them when they arrived downstairs.
"Maybe you could give them the responsibility of making their own breakfasts," Lou had suggested in exasperation.
But since no one had made Jean breakfast when she was growing up, she was determined to make sure that Lily and Isabel got a nourishing breakfast every day. It gave her a special satisfaction to do more for her kids than her parents had done for her. Upon hitting the kitchen every morning, the first thing Jean did was unplug her smartphone from its charger and check her email. She'd become so adept manipulating her phone that it became like an appendage. She could scramble eggs with one hand and operate the phone with the other, thus getting a jump on the day's messages while still providing her kids with a hot meal. As usual, a problem popped up in the first email. "Jean, we'll need you immediately. Terrence is in a swoon. Let me know the second you get here. Thanks, Mort." A graduate of Harvard Law School, Jean had taken a non-partner track position at a Boston firm so she could take care of the girls and accommodate Lou's lifelong ambition to pursue a career in academic medicine like his father. Life at a teaching hospital, especially for doctors on the way up, could be mentally brutal and physically exhausting, so Lou didn't have as much time with his family as he'd like. Jean was glad to make up the difference. At least, she told herself and the rest of the world she was. Her flexible job meant that she was on call for the partners all day. Her informal job description at the firm was crisis manager and troubleshooter for whichever partner nabbed her first. She was so good at thinking on her feet, so smart, and so adept at dealing with difficult people that she'd become the go-to person for all manner of thorny problems, often unrelated to law, the partners wanted help with. Much of her time was spent in a gray zone that didn't fall under the billable hours of legal service. This meant that she was both overworked and underpaid. She contemplated how many hours of handholding and ego-boosting Terrence, a hugely gifted but massively needy client, this current problem would require. She resented Mort for making Terrence's problems her problems. "I've got to speak to Jim about this," she muttered to herself, tapping her foot in annoyance. As the girls inhaled their eggs, she put on her coat and went to the garage to warm up the car, as the thermometer had dipped below 20 degrees. The girls went to two different schools, so Jean had to make two separate stops, not close to each other, before she parked her car and took the subway downtown. Once on the red line, she had a good 30 minutes to herself. She might have lost herself in a novel, but instead she chose to complete reading her backlog of emails and send out replies to them and the early bird texts. Though she was already working, she still treasured the 30-minute ride as her own time. It gave her the illusion that she was running her own show. "Imagine that," she said to herself. "I look forward to riding the subway. What's my life become?" As she got off the train, she heard her phone ring. She didn't recognize the ringtone or the number. Better answer, she thought, worrying that one of her girls might be in trouble.
"Hello, Jean."
It was the development officer from Isabel's school who, following some lovely, flattering talk about what a great kid Isabel was, proceeded to ask Jean if she'd consider chairing the annual auction again.
Flustered, Jean couldn't think of an excuse fast enough before saying that she was honored that the school thought of her for the job, that of course she'd run the auction, and that it was the least she could do, considering how good the school had been for Isabel. After she clicked end, she felt like crying. But she allowed no tears, no time for tears. Instead, she breezed through the revolving doors of one international place, bought her usual no-fat latte at her usual spot. She loved that moment of casual connection with Ashley, the barista, and rode the elevator to the 38th floor. "How I love this ride," she mused to herself as the elevator whooshed its way skyward. "If only the office were on the 1,038th floor." Life in a prison of ADT. Jean's life is typical of that of millions of people who feel they must sacrifice themselves every day to the small stuff at the expense of their own needs. In the process, they risk their health, their relationships, and their jobs. Why does this happen? Life in hyperspeed. Let's take a closer look at the ways Jean's ADT specifically worked against her. Overcommitted, overworked, chronically stressed and tired, but with no chance to slow down, she could no longer call her life her own. Rather, her life comprised a bundle of responses to other people's requests and demands that would assail her in an endless torrent. She was wasting her great mind. Blessed with an IQ that had been tested in school as 149, she was way smart, as her brother would say. When Lou married her, she was slim, beautiful, fun, ambitious, and lively. She received shining reviews at work, but she was also conscientiously hyper-responsive, making herself the potential victim of her own good intentions, her own noble ambitions, her own interests and loves. Her hyper-responsiveness meant that her attention flitted from topic to topic, interruption to interruption, distraction to distraction, staying put only seconds at a time. She was so used to being interrupted that she grew unable to pay attention to anything or anyone for very long. She often jumped the gun and looked elsewhere before the distraction had even arrived, not because she had attention deficit disorder, but because she had conscientious surplus disorder. She didn't want to miss a thing. Any possible chance to please, serve, or be of value. Like so many suffering from ADT, Jean couldn't pay attention because the mental muscles that attention requires had weakened or atrophied. Her attention vectored here and there, as if pulled by hundreds of invisible magnets. When her husband, children, or boss asked her for her full attention, she could no more give it than she could sit down and write a letter by hand. She once knew how to do it, but to try to do it now would only cause frustration. Jean couldn't even get out of bed on her own terms, but had to bargain with herself for a few minutes more of sleep. She accommodated her husband, her children, the partners at her office, and the development officer at her daughter's school, all before she even arrived at her workplace. In addition to feeling that she was responsible for everything, Jean also felt that she had to respond to everything, right here and right now. This led to even more dangerous problems. For example, Jean's tendency to have so many projects going simultaneously, at work, with her children, in the community, with her spouse, meant that it was impossible for her to do her best on any of them. Because the default position in ADT is fast, Jean was also reflexively impatient. Waiting for anything caused her pain. Fast felt right. Slow hurt. The culture of modern life reinforced all this in Jean. She took odd pride in being hurried, having more to do than time to do it, being so in demand. Because she felt guilty relaxing, she busied herself at every turn, cleaning the kitchen, tidying up the closets, brushing the dog,
even when there was no pressing need to do any of these things. Living her life at hyperspeed impaired her sense of time. She always felt she was in a hurry, no matter what the clock said. On the other hand, her desire to get as much done in as short a time as possible was so intense that she often imagined she could do more in, say, 5 minutes than any human possibly could, leading her often to fall short and feel like a failure. For Jean, and for the many others like her, lingering over anything became all but impossible. Jean had to struggle so much that she had trouble clearing the mental space even to listen to others. She completed others' sentences. She interrupted them. This was no surprise, because her life was one long interruption. In her worldview, that was reality. She was so eager to complete whatever conversation she was having in order to get on to the next obligation that she hurried the dialogue along however she could. If the conversation, or the traffic, or the line at the grocery store moved too slowly, she felt she would explode. More than once, she'd left a supermarket, her shopping cart still full, because she couldn't bear how slow the line was. And more than once, she'd suddenly demanded someone to get to the point, losing her alliance with that person in the process. Over time, the stress began to take its inevitable toll. Whenever Jean felt tired or blocked in her race to keep up, she felt that she had to put more pedal to the metal. Working harder supplanted working smarter, as it always does with strung-out people. She stopped going to the gym because she felt she didn't have time for even 20 minutes of daily exercise. For her, working harder and staying up later became what she considered her only viable solution, spinning her into an even more desperate frenzy. Recognizing that things were going wrong, Jean stole some time to peruse a few self-help books in search of a solution. She didn't have time to see a therapist. The closest she got was Joey, her hairdresser and most cherished guilty pleasure. She looked at books on time management, organization, parenting, self-assertion, and anything else that seemed even remotely relevant to her predicament. But none of the books hit the mark. They seemed intended for a simple-minded audience that Jean could not relate to. She actually believed she could manage time just fine. She could organize her stuff, the kids' stuff, and Lou's stuff, but there was not enough time in the day to keep up with everything. Despite the fact that someone came twice a month to clean the house, she felt as if she were always cleaning up other people's messes. She thought she knew how to be a good parent, and she was a good parent, even though she felt guilty she didn't do more. She knew she was not exercising enough, that she was eating too much and not taking good care of herself. But she believed all she had to do was change those habits. She didn't need a book to tell her that. Furthermore, most of the books stressed being assertive, but she could assert herself just fine. And to whom, exactly, was she supposed to assert herself to fix up her life? God? Come bedtime, all she wanted to do was sleep. Lou was no longer the loving, sexy husband whose bones she once wanted to jump. She used to love to lie in his arms and bury her head into his chest. Now he was just that body lying on the other side of the mattress. ADT had poisoned her relationship with her spouse. Jean enters the danger zone.
I guess you forgot I turned a year older today, Lou said very quietly one night as they were getting into bed.
Jean had completely forgotten his birthday. Instead of apologizing, she snapped. I can't remember everything, you know, and aren't you a little old to be worrying about a birthday? Should I have baked a cake and invited all your friends and put little hats on all of you so you could blow out all your candles and sing happy birthday? Why don't you help me out instead of worrying about your damn birthday? Don't you know how much I sacrifice so you can pursue your precious academic career?
Do you know how much crap I have to put up with so you can follow in your perfect father's footsteps? Do you have any idea how much stress I carry around so you can worry about your fucking birthday?
Had Jean been in her right mind following her tirade, she would have realized what she had done and apologized for taking out on Lou the frustrations that had built up in her all day, all week, all year. But she did not apologize, and Lou said nothing. He simply got out of bed and went to sleep in the guest bedroom. The marriage would survive, but it would ache for a long time. As her to-do lists grew longer, and Lou, feeling hurt, withdrew support, she slept less and worried more. The worrying became an ambient noise. She went to sleep with it and woke up with it. Her stressful feelings hung like a cowl over her head, darkening the atmosphere in the house. The more she had to do, the more she procrastinated, and the more her productivity suffered. Her boss noticed and said so in her performance review. Depressed, Jean began to spin out of control. Her lack of exercise soon led her to feel less alert and more in need of some other kind of fix. So she turned to the comforts of macaroni and cheese, pizza, and fried chicken. She didn't give a damn. Let me be fat. Really fat. Why not? She thought. Who cares? She didn't dare get on the scales. Her weight gain made her even crankier, so she started to drink 3 or 4 glasses of wine each evening. The alcohol impaired the quality of the little sleep she did manage to get, so she awoke more tired and with a hangover. She was in greater danger than she knew. Since Lou had begun spending more long nights at the hospital, Jean started to flirt with random people. The checkout guy at Whole Foods. The gas station attendant who always eyed her and whose butt she liked. And the older gentleman at the liquor store who so reminded her of her high school English teacher. She didn't go so far as to have an affair, but she realized that she was giving off signals she couldn't control. She began to feel physically ill as well. She developed aches and pains in her neck and lower back, pains she'd never had before, and had indigestion after every meal, as well as often between meals. Her sense of zest and vitality, long her trademarks, all but disappeared. Now and then a colleague or a friend would ask her gently if anything was wrong. "Why do you ask?" she'd snap defensively. "So I put on a few pounds. So I'm not a slave to the ridiculous image the media makes women aspire to. Fact is, I'm proud to be me." The inquiring person would learn not to inquire again. Increasingly, Jean became isolated and alone. Jean entered what I call the danger zone, an acronym summarized as D, disappointment, defeat, leads to A, anger, and blame leads to N, negativity, leads to G, globalizing of negative feelings, leads to E, escape into wasteful or dangerous activities, leads to R, rejection of help, of others, of life. In the danger zone, everything in a person's life comes under threat. So it was with Jean. Her marriage, her kids' well-being, her job, and even her life itself, all hung in the balance. The Children of ADT, Jean's Backstory. Usually, the worldview that children develop when they are young persists throughout their lives. But what we do as children to help us cope with life at home can become maladaptive in adulthood. As with the other characters in this book, this was the case with Jean. Jean was the 4th of 6 siblings. She grew up in an era when parents didn't pay much attention to kids, certainly not doting on them as they do now. She recalled her grandmother sternly admonishing her when she asked for a story during the adult sacrosanct cocktail hour. "Jean, you must learn that children should be seen and not heard. Run along now and let the grown-ups talk." Her parents were good people, but they were busy themselves and didn't fuss over her. She never had to worry about what grades she got in school because her parents barely noticed and because school was easy anyway. She didn't have to worry about passing inspection on her clothes because she dressed herself from an early age, made her own breakfast, and headed out the door to the school bus, often without even a goodbye, let alone a kiss. She didn't feel neglected. This was just the way life was. Looking back, she realized she had faced a choice as a child. Like so many of our most important choices, it was not a conscious choice, but it was undeniably a choice. She could get the attention she so craved from her parents in one of two ways. She could be bad, or she could be good. Her two older brothers chose bad. Stealing and getting into trouble with drugs gained them a lot of attention. But Jean hadn't wanted that kind of attention, so she chose good. Being good gradually took her over and became part of her wiring, her psychic DNA, so that being anything but good became all but impossible. Jean also learned that saying yes and being accommodating was taken to be a sign of good character and virtue. From her Girl Scout leaders and school teachers, she learned that it was important to contribute above and beyond. Such beliefs ruled her in her adult life. If she failed to meet others' expectations, not to mention her own, impossible though they may have been, she blamed herself and felt guilty for what she hadn't done. Her self-esteem then took a hit. And if she ever had time to slow down and goof off, she didn't take it for fear of violating her code, as if committing a serious sin. The entrenched need to say yes and to be good meant that, for her, saying no felt as foreign and impossible as waking up speaking Swahili or feeling that she had turned into a bird. She really couldn't comprehend not fulfilling everyone's requests of her. It was painful to even imagine telling her boss that she might be unreachable during the weekend, or telling her kids that she couldn't be interrupted when she was in the shower. Ironically, by the time Jean was in the danger zone, this good girl, who had said yes to everything and everyone, and who had so sought approval, was no longer approved of. She was coming apart. What is beneficial? What isn't? Useful qualities can become problematic in most people who allow modern life to spin them into ADT. Jean's backstory, her childhood, created susceptibility to ADT. But then the conditions of modern life created the full-blown condition. The good news is that people with ADT have a lot of grit and resilience. They usually find a way out of the danger zone. Of course, I'm talking about the people who self-select to consult with me, the resourceful ones who can admit that they have a problem and are willing to seek help. By the time they see me, it's almost certain that the worst is over and they are already on their way back to a more peaceful state of mind. The ones who do collapse and lose most of what they have are the people who refuse to seek help and allow themselves to become so isolated that they implode. In Jean's case, she became unable to follow the basic plan because her energy was so low that none of the other elements were possible. Her challenge was simply in freeing up time to sleep, eat, exercise, and preserve some downtime, perhaps even make love. The challenge was, as it is with everyone struggling to regain focus, both psychological and strategic. I had to encourage her to give herself permission not to please everyone all the time. I concentrated both on helping her learn new structures that would save her time and on helping her learn how to allow herself to say no rather than to always say yes. One example of the new structures I taught her is the acronym CDE, which stands for Curtail, Delegate, Eliminate. I also encouraged her to speak directly to her supervisor. She needed to change her job description so that she was not at everyone's beck and call. But to do this, she had to short-circuit her yes responder. How I help a person do this varies, but I usually combine encouragement with role-playing, followed by the person testing the new behavior out in real life and then reporting back what worked well. The reason Jean hadn't tried any of this before was because on the deepest level, she feared that saying no risked her losing everything. Saying no, to her, represented a forbidden breach of the rules she'd followed her entire life. As I said earlier, much of our adult behavior is rooted in what we had to do as children, imagined we had to do, were told we had to do, or all of the above, in order to get what we needed to survive. Jean now had to learn that the rules of her childhood no longer applied. That now, in fact, it was safe to say no. Indeed, it was a really good idea to say no. But it took a crisis, her near unraveling, before she felt the desperation of being shipwrecked. Although she did not hit bottom, she came close enough to break down her ingrained style of coping. In pain, she reached for a new idea, for something to which to cling. It was simply this: I want a life for myself. She became like the character in the movie Network, who screamed out his window, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." That anger would set her free. But it took a lot of heat to melt the door of the vault she'd put that anger into. In terms of the basic plan, Jean's issues created the following problems. 1. Energy. Jean was run ragged by her insistence on being the perfect good girl, the one who got everything done and done well. 2. Emotion. Anger built up in her as inevitably as debt builds up when you overspend. 3. Engagement. She overengaged. She couldn't focus long enough on anything to tend to it well. 4. Structure. Jean's emotional makeup prevented her from setting up the structures and boundaries that could save her. 5. Control. She gave over control to her fastidious sense of duty and her compulsion to please others. What to do about it? 10 tips for multitaskers and people who can't say no. 1. It is neurologically impossible to concentrate on two tasks at once. What people really mean by multitasking is switching attention from one task to another in rapid succession. If both tasks are boring, like talking to a dull person on your cell phone while unloading the dishwasher, then you can get away with it. But if either or both of the tasks are complex, like talking to a smart person on your cell phone while writing a report on a complicated investment, then both the conversation and the report will suffer, as will you. 2. It's fun to multitask, and it gives the illusion of saving time, which is why so many people talk on their phones while doing email and also following the stream on their Bloomberg terminals. But beware. You may feel like a master of the universe while you do it, but the chances that you will miss critical information rise exponentially with each task you add. 3. On the other hand, you can multitask when what you're doing is either automatically mediated, like breathing and maintaining balance in a chair, or requires no concentration, like taking a shower while listening to music on an iPod. Indeed, strictly speaking, we all multitask, even when we're asleep, as our minds and bodies are always doing many things. 4. Multitasking is only dangerous when one or more of the tasks requires attention and focus in the present moment. And then it's as dangerous as drinking and driving. For example, you can drive your car while listening to your radio, but you better take your focus off the radio when you get close to your exit, or you're likely to drive past it, unless you know the route on automatic pilot. But texting while in a meeting, or worse, while driving, may cost you dearly. 5. The inability to say no, which is an occupational hazard of kind and conscientious people, can put you into a perpetual state of overload. Practice politely declining requests. 6.
A good way to say no is to say, I'd love to do that if I had the time, but as it is, I could not give it the attention it deserves, so I would not be able to perform as well as you and the task warrant. 7. Explain to yourself that it is right, good, and proper to say no. If you always say yes, you will soon burn out and be of little use to your organization, your family, or yourself. 8. Learn to delegate. The goal in today's world is not to be independent, but to be interdependent in such a way that you give as much as you get. 9. Element 3 in the basic plan, engagement, happens most easily when you are doing what you are good at and what you like to do. Say yes to those opportunities. 10. Understand that you do everyone a favor when you say no. You are simply stating that you are not the person who is best for that task at the present time. The organization benefits by knowing that and should thank you. Chapter 3. Idea Hopping. How to finish what you start. People who fit the category of ADT outlined in this chapter tend to agree with the following statements. I have so many ideas, I don't know what to do with them all. I love the start of projects and the conclusion. It's the middle I have trouble with. I stay awake at night with new ideas running through my mind. I avoid doing difficult work by doing busy work. My actions can't keep up with my imagination. I get bored when the novelty of a new project wears off. My biggest problem is learning how to prioritize. My problem is that nothing grabs me enough for me to stick with it when it gets boring. No, 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 Brian yelled. I can't go down this road again. I've told you I'll back you in whatever you want to do, but I can't back you anymore in refusing to make up your mind.
Brian, I'm not refusing. I just can't. Please understand.
I can't understand. Believe me, I've tried. Right now it's pretty hard for me not to see you just as a spoiled rich woman who's nothing but a dilettante.
Ashley felt stunned, as if hit with a brick.
Screw you, Brian. What a horrible thing for you to say. Life's no problem for you because things come easily to you. You might offer me some understanding instead of your smug little judgments.
Ashley, I'm sorry. You're right. What I said was mean. But I'm just so frustrated. I don't know what to say.
You're frustrated? How do you think I feel? It's my life I'm wasting.
Well, not your whole life. The kids and me count for something, I hope.
Of course you do. But how would you feel if you had no career, even though you had instant access to all the backing you could ever need, but all you could come up with was ideas with no follow-through? I feel like a 2-year-old. I can't stick with anything.
Ashley and Brian had a strict rule never to go to bed angry. So when they shut off the light at 11 o'clock, he reached out to her, and she snuggled into the crook of his shoulder. He stroked her back gently.
I love you, he said, giving her a soft kiss. Then he turned on his side. Soon his breathing slowed, and he was fast asleep.
As usual, Ashley lay wide awake, staring at the ceiling, listening to the sound of the crickets outside. She could feel tears in the corners of her eyes. She knew Brian was right. She was a rich man's spoiled wife, and she was a dilettante. She'd never had the stick-to-itiveness, or whatever it took, to follow through on a project. It wasn't that her ideas weren't good. It was just that she had too many of them, and, like a bee in a garden full of flowers, as soon as she landed on a sweet-smelling red rose of a concept, she was distracted by the tall blue delphinium of another cool idea, or the honeysuckle lining the fence with more ideas. Why couldn't she stick with one flower long enough to follow through? She most definitely had the entrepreneurial itch, which is almost always associated with symptoms of ADT.
but her version of ADT brought to mind the nursery rhyme about the old woman who lived in a shoe. Only in this instance, she had so many ideas, she didn't know what to do. Ideas swirled in Ashley's head like a pile of dead leaves hit by a gust of wind.